Welcome to the Interpreter Foundation podcast. I'm Terry Hutchinson. My co-hosts are Mark Johnson and Kevin Christensen. Our discussion topic for this podcast is actually an interview with a person. It's David John Butler, who's written several books. We will get into that in a minute. And basically, our discussion is going to be with him about his books and the Book of Mormon. So the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. We invite you to see what Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. So if you like this podcast, tell your friends about it. You can give us a 5-star rating. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, any other podcast app that you might use. Because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. Now, before we begin our discussion topic, we've got another announcement here, and that is to announce that if you're looking for a fabulous trip this summer, you want a marvelous family experience or a Christmas or other gift, you can join the Interpreter Foundation for a meticulously crafted tour of Great Britain led by Dan Peterson, Chris Fredrickson, and Peter Fagg. We'll explore storied LDS church history sites, learn about the missionaries who sacrificed much to preach the gospel in the UK, and those who converted to the church. We'll explore renowned cathedrals, palaces, quaint villages, spectacular locales, participate in local cultural events, and conclude with 4 memorable days in London, one of the world's greatest cities. And on a side note, my brother's been all over the world. London is his favorite city in the world. Spaces are limited, so book your reservations now by visiting the Bountiful Travel website. You can visit them at bountifultravel.com or call 801-453-9444. Again, bountifultravel.com or 801-453-9444. So now let's get back to our discussion topic with D. John Butler, David John Butler. And before we begin, David, you recently were notable for something else. I think you are the David Butler who started a GoFundMe account. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a give, send, go. Yeah, I am.
You're the guy.
I am that guy. Yes.
Tell us about that.
It's delightful to me how many people first guessed that it was somebody else, and then only as a second or even a third option said, "Was it you?"
Well, when they said David Butler, I thought of the other David Butler.
Are you and everybody else?
The
Terry,
one with a different look to his hair.
Yes. I did say on day 2, when it was suggested that the whole thing was a psyop by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to get good press, I did say, guys, come on. If the church was going to do a publicity psyop, would their guy have a mustache and long hair? Obviously not. I am that guy. Yeah, it was an amazing experience. I don't know what to say about it. I guess if anyone is unaware, the last Sunday of September, I think the 28th, in Grand Blanc, Michigan, Thomas Jacob Sanford, crashed his truck into the side of a chapel while they were preparing for sacrament meeting, splashed gasoline on the building, got out with a rifle, and, killed 4 people. And was killed himself. And I am the guy who on Tuesday morning after that set up the Give, Send, Go to help the widow of the shooter and his chronically ill son. We can talk as much about that as you want or as little. I will say when I did it, I thought that if we were lucky, we might raise $20,000. And 12 hours later, it was at $100,000, and U.S. senators were retweeting it. So it was an absolutely astonishing experience. For the most part, it was an experience of standing inside a storm of people expressing love and generosity and sympathy and care and support. And then there were There were just little people in that storm kind of stabbing me, telling me I shouldn't be doing this and it was not appropriate. And just a little bit of that, but mostly it was an amazing experience.
Well, what really caused the thought in your mind? What struck you? I mean, obviously, when you look at it from the outside now, it's like, oh yeah, of course. But nobody else thought of it. So how did it generate inside of you?
I am embarrassed to say that I'm pretty sure that somebody else did think of it. I'm embarrassed to tell you who it is that I think did think of it, because like I don't want to give them any credit, to be honest, but I'm going to. I was on Monday night, looking, checking in on X and Twitter, and I am pretty sure there was a tweet by the LDS Democrats. I think that's the name of the account. And it said something like, and I'm not a Democrat. Some of you guys might be, I am not. But the tweet said something. Okay, Kevin is.
I know Kevin is. I stay away from that.
All right. Yeah. I like I said, man, this is, but credit where credit is due. And the tweet said something like, hey, has anyone thought about the widow of Jake Sanford? And I went and looked and nobody had. Or if they had, it was not, nothing had been done, right? And so Terry, it wasn't even my idea. I have very little virtue here, right? I thought, well, someone should do that. I took the dogs for a walk to kind of clear my head and sort out my feelings, make sure I was doing it for right reasons and that it wasn't insane. By the time I finished the walk, I got back and I texted. I'm sort of a fringe character on the, let's call it the high energy faithful side of the YouTubosphere, LDS accounts like Jacob Hansen's Thoughtful Faith or All Those in Favor or Ward Radio or Stick of Joseph. I'm familiar with those, Greg Matson. So I texted some of those guys and said, listen, I think I'm going to do this. Will you help me publicize it? And they said yes. And so Tuesday morning, I actually
And
did.
it
You said
went.
GoFundMe. I fiddled with GoFundMe and could not get it to work. And there's a whole subsequent thread in the story about GoFundMe's absolutely atrocious public or customer service. I couldn't make that work. So I set up GiveSendGo. It was like a tricycle, super easy. And it basically blew up immediately.
Well, thanks for sharing that. That is not why we had you on the program. Although, Kevin, you and your crew can take a little credit. All right.
Yes, should.
Mormon Democrats in action.
I believe. I went back and tried to find that tweet and I couldn't. So I don't know if they deleted it or like ChatGPT that did I possibly hallucinate it, but I'm pretty confident that I saw a post. And I think that's where it
Well,
was from.
wherever it came from, it's been a great blessing for them and the family, I'm sure. So, anyway, let's talk a little bit about why you're here, Dave, if we could. So, you are the author of a few books. Let me just mention them, and there might be more. The Goodness and the Mysteries on the Path of the Book of Mormon's Visionary Men, Plain and Precious Things, The Temple Religion of the Book of Mormon's Visionary Men. And then your latest, I believe, is in the language of Adam, reading scripture like the Book of Mormon's Visionary Men. Now, I think, like Margaret Barker, your books build on each other. So tell us what the first one is and then how they lead into one another, if you would.
I'm digging at the same hole. I've never left. I'm still digging the same hole. So they do build on one another. Having said that, I deliberately wrote in the language of Adam so that if you said, Dave, I don't want to read three books, what should I read? You should read that. It will be accessible to you. It's intended to be accessible without having read the first two. So I am not an academic. I had thought at one point I would be an academic. I studied Hebrew on my mission. A fun fact, my mission president at one zone conference, he got up and said, I need to remind you all that the only things you are allowed to read are the standard works and the Missionary Library, which was, I think at the time it was four volumes. I think maybe it's five now, or beginning as Jesus the Christ, Articles of Faith, Marvelous Work and a Wonder, and something else, I forget what. He said, that's all you can read. He said, oh, except Elder Butler. Elder Butler can read whatever he wants.
I wish my mission president would have said that.
Was great. I was at the time the finance secretary. He knew I was
Oh,
reading everything in the office. He knew I was reading, like, we had the Journal of Discourses, and we had, I would buy everything we had access to in the catalog. So I was reading Joseph F. and Joseph Fielding and whatever I could get. So I taught myself some Hebrew. I came back thinking that I might do that professionally, but then I met a girl who agreed to marry me, and I wanted to get married, and she didn't want to be poor, and that seemed fair. So I went to law school instead of getting a PhD. What I did then is for the next 3 years of law school, but then 5 years while I worked in London, and a year while I was working in Manhattan and living in Connecticut, and I was just riding trains for hours every day, was just keep reading. My undergraduate degree is in Near Eastern Studies at BYU. And I kept studying languages. I would ride the train in from Surrey into London to my law firm job. And when everyone else was reading Harry Potter, all these bankers and lawyers reading Harry Potter, I had James Allen's Middle Egyptian Grammar, right? Or I was reading Martha Himmelfarb or whoever. I was I have seen myself for a long time as a Book of Mormon guy. And I had this strong feeling that the Book of Mormon had some connection with the apocalyptic writings of the intertestamental period of the Second Temple. And I couldn't articulate it. And so I was just sort of reading these books over and over again, reading the Book of Mormon over and over again, studying languages, sort of staring at this brick wall. I felt like there was a brick wall right in front of my face, and I felt like there was something on the other side of it, but I couldn't articulate it fully. So fast forward through years of that, I am living in Eagle, Idaho, and the counselors to the newly reorganized Elders Quorum come to my house on a Sunday afternoon, and they say, here is your home teaching assignment. I say, great. And then they stay, and they don't say anything, and they kind of shift from foot to foot. And I said, you must have a calling to offer me. And they said, we do. And I said, since you guys just got called yourself half an hour ago, I assume it has to be Elders Quorum instructor. And they said, yes. And I said, I will do it. I said, you will never have to remind me. I will always be prepared. And I will never teach out of the manual. And they said, let us think about it. So they got back to me. I think the Elders Quorum president, Steve Jones, went golfing with his dad and consulted with Bishop Hosack, and they came back and said, okay, we'll try this out. So I started what was a 10-year run of teaching in Elders Quorums, where I basically used my obligation at the time. Elders Quorum was every week, of course, and I was alternating with another instructor. So every other week I had to come up with an hour, right? And that became sort of a driving engine for me to get my thoughts together. And I did stuff like I built a scale model of Solomon's Temple on foam board, and I like made little furniture, spray painted it gold, and bought little Nephite action figures to be different actors to work through and figure out, kind of organize my thoughts around this stuff. And I know this is a very long answer, but this is the risk with me, Terry. I've been a corporate trainer for 10 years. It's like Teddy Ruxpin. If you poke me, I just start talking.
It's fine.
Okay. I'm
That's
getting
what
to
podcasts are about. If this was radio, I'd be interrupting you every 2 minutes.
perfect long form. So people are listening at like 1.75x speed anyway. Just to my parts, you guys, they listen to a regular speed. In 2010, this has been going on for a couple of years. I've been practicing law for 11 years. We transactioned the company where I was chief corporate counsel. So I got sort of a payday and I could decide what I wanted to do. And a more ambitious sort of lawyer type would have said, great, this is where I step up and become general counsel and I pay off my mortgage and et cetera. I said, no, this is where I'm going to become a science fiction fantasy writer. So I started writing full time for sort of 2.5 years while I could. And in the process of that, when I was sort of in this mode of every day writing 12 or 15 pages, I said, you know what, I need to. I felt that I needed to get my thoughts on the Book of Mormon kind of in shape. So, in I think summer and fall of 2012, I wrote the first two books in kind of a white hot furore. And they are, I mean, every book becomes, any book that makes an argument becomes dated, right? The mark of a book is not that its arguments are all correct, it's that that advances the discussion in a useful direction. And in that sense, I stand by them. But they were awkward. I was trying to figure out how to get into this idea that the Book of Mormon was temple literature. And I had been reading Margaret's stuff, but as well as John J. Collins and Paul D. Hansen and all the usual suspects, right? I got them all over there in my shelves. And I sort of thought that the door to entry had to be the Day of Atonement. And so kind of that's how I worked in the first book. And to explain the Day of Atonement, I felt like I had to talk about the Deuteronomic reform. So it's a bit of an awkward entry into the subject. I published the first book, Plain and Precious Things. I said, look, I don't, by the way, if you look at the original edition, it is, there is no loveliness in it that we should desire it. I deliberately made the book ugly. Like I commissioned a painting for the cover, but I deliberately used a template. I had this idea that people should want it for its contents. I was like anti-marketing. Okay. I don't know why that seemed like a good idea to me, but that's what I did. So you see this kind of really obviously self-published edition still out there. I took this book, I thought I should tell some people about it. My neighbor, Ryan, said, oh, there's this great forum called Mormon Stories. I said, I've never heard of them. He said, they're like, it's a place for different Mormons, and you're like a different Mormon. I said,
Not
okay.
that different.
Yeah, so I went and I got on Mormon Stories Facebook page, right? I had never, I knew there was a guy named John Dillon associated with it. I didn't know anything about him, never seen a podcast. And I posted and I said, or Facebook is a group, not a page. And I said, hey, I wrote this book. Here's a little summary of the argument. The first response, which came in minutes, was, they're killing gay people. How can you even talk about this when they're killing the gay? And I was like, what? So I just, all right, forget it. Like, I'm just not going to market the book. The book exists. And then shortly afterwards, I wrote a second book to kind of push the argument a little further. And then basically I left it. Over the next 10 years, I would hear from people. I'd get an email, someone would say, listen, I'm a gospel doctrine teacher in Osaka and I want to pick your brain about something. Or, I'm a writer, I'm a teacher class, whatever. I got invited to give firesides at a few wards, here out in Kansas City, Idaho. Sorry, here is Utah. I live in Utah now. Fun fact, actually, I'm in the original home of Stephen R. Covey and Sandra Covey that they built in 1958. I'm actually in Stephen's office. This is never, the lights are all, the copper's corroded away, but that's like a popcorn style plaster ceiling and these wooden Madeira Cold War era walls. This is, I'm in Stephen Covey's historic office. Anyway, trivia, parenthetical. So the books kind of they just went their way and had a life, right? This was not my career. I went and was a corporate trainer. I was pushing forward my science fiction fantasy novelist career. My 20th novel came out last month, right? So I'm obscure, but I have a career. And then in 2024, it's complicated. In 2023, I started a business. It seemed amazing. We had this client. He is super famous and super rich. And by the way, it looked like the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was going to fund him to do this corporate training. And we started this business, and it existed for 7 months. And then a combination of Hamas attacking Israel on October 7th and turning Saudi Arabia's attention elsewhere, and some other sort of internal problems, whole thing blew up. And suddenly I went from being very busy to having nothing to do in the beginning of 2024. Just ghost town. It was tumbleweeds blowing through the empty office. And at exactly the same time, out of nowhere, I got invited on four different YouTube channels. Rick Mattson was one of them, but sorry, Greg Mattson. Rick Bennett was one of them, and Stick of Joseph, Oak Norton, out of nowhere, for four unrelated reasons, all invited me on their channels, and it just I had been thinking for a decade about these things. I had realized there were much better ways to get into the topic. It's very difficult to put your first foot forward as the Deuteronomic reform. It turns out you can say things about Heavenly Mother to Mormons, and they'll be like, "Well, maybe not a problem." If you say, "Listen, Josiah killed a lot of people. They may not have been all evil." People get very uncomfortable very fast. I figured out there are better ways to get into the subject. And so I sat down and wrote book three in another sort of white hot furore in February of 2024. And while I was writing it, the two brothers who are the Stick of Joseph podcast said, I mean, I told them I'm going to write a book, and they were like, "Oh yeah." And then I actually wrote a book, and they said, "Oh, holy cow." And they said, "Listen, we wanted to start a publishing company anyway. Why don't you start one with us?" And so we launched the book and bootstrapped that from zero money, no cash investment at all, to into a publisher. That's where I have no academic training. I am a guy who reads. I'm a guy who likes languages. I am a guy who's been obsessing about the Book of Mormon for a long time. I think there is a genetic relationship between the Book of Mormon and the apocalyptic literature. I think what it is that the Book of Mormon is written by people who are visionaries, who are temple visionaries. This is interesting because you guys have not expressed views, so I may be like saying things that cheese you off immensely right now. But let me say this: it is a fundamental mistake to think that in the first temple period there was one religious party in Judah, much less in Judah and Israel both. It is very clear from the Old Testament, not to mention the archaeology, that and a classic book on the subject, maybe like Morton Smith's "Palestinian Parties and Politics That Shaped the Old Testament," is a great book. Okay. A little dated now, but it's got great information. There were multiple religious parties. We read this in the text of the Old Testament.
Well, it's in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's I've got a couple of volumes on that as well.
The Dead Sea Scrolls are, and they gave us great insight into the fact that in the Second Temple period, again, there was not one Hebraic, one Yahwist religion. There are people that disagreed with each other and fought each other, excommunicated each other, killed each other, compromise with each other, right? I think that the Lehi party are a party of temple mystics who knew a temple ascent and associated it with the Temple of Solomon. Structurally, ideologically, whether they actually had been inside Solomon's temple or not. And I think that they write the Book of Mormon assuming that the audience will have basically the same experience. And seeing that as a way to access additional layers of meaning in the Book of Mormon text. That's what all three books are about.
Okay. Well, thank you for giving us those introductions. Mark and Kevin, you probably have some additional questions.
I was going to ask real quick. I had noticed this is I've got. Oh,
Oh,
there it
yeah.
went. Sorry, I got the fake background on here.
It's all right.
On a note, Dave, we're just recording audio. We can see each other, but the
But I do have my
podcast is
book,
only audio.
oh,
Oh, so
and
me showing my camera was pointless. Tragic.
tragic's a little strong. We don't need to. We don't need to go
It was
there.
what we needed. All
Yes.
right. Fair enough.
Helps
Mark,
spur the
sorry to cut you
conversation.
off.
No problem. I had noticed that this new book is quite attractive, and when I was in it doesn't have the large print like the earlier editions did.
Yeah. I got
And I
complaints
also
about that.
noticed that in addition to having a publisher that local retailer had other books by the same publisher, and I thought
Yeah.
that was kind of cool. I look forward to seeing what they've done too.
Yeah, I think we've got oh, one, two, three, four, five. I think our sixth book just came out, and it's a children's picture book, or is in pre-order now. So yeah, it's like a thing.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
One of the things that you talk about in these books is essentially, I'm not, hopefully not giving anything away to our readers, but you liken a lot of the material in Lehi's dream of the Tree of Life to these visionary temple experiences. And number of years ago, I was reading through, and this was before I'd come across your books, reading, First Nephi 8, and I wondered how his vision might be viewed also as like a political polemic against the establishment back in Jerusalem. He'd left at the time, so they didn't necessarily have, contact. He wasn't preaching the contents of this vision to the in his ministry as he was going out and preaching against the other religious groups. But just reading the chapter there, and seeing this great and spacious building, it made me wonder, how that would relate to a fallen temple. Was the great and spacious building the temple that was being commandeered by the other religious groups, how that fits.
The First Nephi 8 was one of these things that I really, for a long time, I said, this is just obviously an ascent text. But the thing that bothered me for a long time is that it doesn't end in a throne, it ends in a tree, which is not how most ascent texts work. I mean, I think the answer to that may turn out to be remarkably simple, which is that actually the tree is the throne. And that's maybe a different conversation. And by the way, another way to think about this is the whole book opens up with a vision of the throne. And I think there are different ways to kind of think about the structure of the book. And one way is a sort of an Ouroboros-like structure where you get into 2 Nephi 32. Sorry, I say the book, but I mean Nephi's writings. 2 Nephi 32, and he's winding up and he talks about asking, seeking, knocking, standing in the straight and narrow path. And then he says, the Spirit stops my utterance as if he is at the veil and will not tell you more. Sort of suggesting that one way to see the structure is that we start with a throne and the book brings us right up to the the brink of seeing the throne again, and then Nephi stops, right? But another way to see it is to think, well, we saw the throne in First Nephi 1, and here, and it just goes right in First Nephi 8. But I think more simply, the throne is the tree. But another reason why sort of it's not been obvious, maybe, that it's an ascent account is because of the sort of negative valorization of the images, right? There are mists of darkness. There are people in very fine clothing who are in a great and spacious building, and they're sneering, right? And this is one of the things that I worked my way through. This is why I built the 3D model of Solomon's, because we
Dave,
talked through it
you're
maybe in
breaking
Old
up a
Testament
little
class,
bit
but
for
it's hard
some
to know
reason.
why we should care.
I don't.
That is strange because I'm plugged into my landline. Is it possibly you?
Seems okay on my end.
Could be mine.
Just a little bit. Nothing serious.
Okay.
Nothing
Okay.
serious.
Let's go ahead.
Okay. Let me rewind like a few seconds here. So there the look the when I say it's an ascent text, what I mean is that the structure and furnishings of Solomon's temple are the sort of skeletons upon which the visionary images are cast. But we're used to seeing those as glorious, like First Enoch 15 and 16. It's walls of fire and it's beings of light, right? And rather than mists of darkness. But I think there are a number of clues linguistically, as well as the basic organization of sort of the three-part structure, the field as it was the world, the sort of middle ground, which is where the great and spacious building is across the water, and then the presence of the tree, right? Sort of three-part space. And I think that the Lehi, or at least Nephi in his account of Lehi, drops the actual names of those rooms as we have them in the books of Kings and Chronicles. He says the field is wide as it was a world. Well, a world in Hebrew is Olam, and the name of that porch, the first room in the temple, is the Ulam. And then he talks about a great and spacious building in this center space, and the proper name of the center room in Solomon's temple is the Heikal, which, by the way, is also a name for the entire building, and it's very old. It comes from Akkadian, but before that, from Sumerian, and an Agal is a big house. It is where a Lugal, a big man, lives. Okay, it is the palace of the king. And so, literally, you look in dictionaries, look up the word Heikal in Hebrew dictionaries, and they will say something very, very similar to a great and spacious building. In fact, I think it's Menachem Haran in his Temples and Temple Service in Ancient Israel. He might even get within like one word of a bullseye. I forget exactly what he says, but it's an Heikal is any large and spacious building, I think, maybe is what he says. Right, like so again, Lehi is dropping the name. The proper name of the backspace is the Debir. An etymologist will say this just means the back part. But many people have, including anciently, have taken the name Debir to connect etymologically to the root of the word for word or speech. Okay, Deber is to speak. Davar is a word. It's also thing. By the way, it looks, again, whether it is or not, it looks related to Devorah, the bumblebee. There's a bunch of really interesting associations around the Holy of Holies. And this is where Lehi stands and speaks to his kin as they are approaching or not, right? So he seems to sort of drop names and also images. And this so I think that the so your question, Mark, right? This is the Dave talks too long problem. Your question
No.
is, is like, hey, is there an anti-establishment polemic here? Yeah, I think there is. I think you see it in particular in the middle part of the journey, where the altar from the, sorry, the incense from the incense altar in the second room, okay, which you can see also, by the way, in Isaiah 6, right? There's an incense altar there. And it seemed the function of the incense seems to be that it's a cloud of smoke, among other things, maybe, that if the veil opens, the smoke will protect, and you're there in that middle room, the smoke will protect you from being killed by the presence of God's glory, right? Divinity is dangerous stuff. So, but in this vision, it's dark. It leads people astray. Similarly, the great and spacious building, it is the proper name for that room, but it's also the proper name for the building as a whole, right? I think that is literally an image for the temple. And there's this peculiar description that it's as it were above the ground, suggesting that it's not literally above the ground, it's above the ground in some other sense, as it were above the ground. And I think Nibley's comparison was to like the mud skyscrapers of the Arab cities in the Arabian Peninsula, where there are no cities on the ground floor. So at night, that's interesting. I believe in and the power of and more than one concurrent explanation, right? Multivalent symbolism. I also think that what Nephi, possibly faithfully capturing Lehi, right, is saying is, look, this is an image of the corrupt, the captured temple. And people in it who are wearing very fine clothing, which is the priestly class, are sneering at Lehi, right? I think there's another indication, Mark, that that Lehi not only saw the temple captured by hostiles, or Nephi slash Lehi did, but that they characterize them as foreigners. So late in chapter 8, and I don't have any books open in front of me, but in 1 Nephi chapter 8, he uses the word strange late in the chapter. And I think he uses it in reference to paths and the building, the great and spacious building. Now, if you look at the King James Bible, which is, probably not an infallible guide to Book of Mormon's Hebrew, underlying Hebrew, but like it's what we have. So there are two words that are translated as strange from biblical Hebrew into English, and neither one of them means weird. They mean foreign. So when Nephi says, people got lost in foreign, strange paths, it's foreign paths, right? And they went into that foreign building. And I think absolutely there is an ascent text here. Absolutely there's a family story here. Absolutely. There is Nephi retrojecting history onto this account to talk about what has happened to his family since this vision. And I absolutely think that Lehi is saying, look, Nephi, Lehi are saying, we have been excluded from this temple. Adherents of an ideology that we regard as foreign and hostile have taken it over.
Oh yeah, I definitely agree with that. There's a First Nephi 1:19, where he says there's going to be a Messiah in the redemption of the world. That's directly addressing the changes that have just happened. They've just gotten rid of the Messiah. They've changed that the high priest is no longer the anointed, no longer has the name on his forehead, no longer represents the Lord, and the redemption of the world is dramatized in the Day of the Atonement ritual. So. And I just finished reading the book this week, and I noticed there's lots of this kind of detective work is all the way through it. Showing temple imagery, temple word, temple language, going through these accounts, and it kind of reminds me of when I grew up in an era when I'm 71 now, when people would say if the Book of Mormon contains the fullness of the gospel, how come there's nothing about the temple? You'd say, well, the temple is a separate thing, and then there's a popular essay that was first in Sunstone and reprinted several times called The Reconstruction of Mormon Doctrine, where they wanted to distinguish or tried to trace a break from early Mormonism, which is Book of Mormon Mormonism, and then a change to Nauvoo Temple Mormonism, where they're trying to say there's this discontinuity and change. And that was kind of the environment. And then Jack Welch sent out a little one-page summary of what was going to go into his books on illuminating the Sermon at the Temple and the Sermon on the Mount, just showing the temple steps there. That blew my mind. And then, and I so I did comparisons with Eliade's Cosmos and History, Myth of the Eternal Return, in one of my essays. And then I heard a story from Gordon Thomason, who talks about when he was an assistant to Nibley, came into the office one day, and Nibley turned around and he said, "Kick me." And Thomas said, "No, why would I want to do that?" And he says, "Just they'd been studying, you know, ancient temple stuff." And he says, "Just read these chapters in the Book of Mormon in light of what we've been studying for the past several months, you know." And he was just like Alma 9 to 13. And that's when they just said, "Yeah, it's all there. And you know, you've got that, you know, the same kind of stuff in your book." So it's this increasing awareness of the temple. And I just, when I reviewed the annotated Book of Mormon, you know, even Grant Hardy was saying in there, says, well, some people think that there's a temple in the Book of Mormon, but you know, if you look for the modern temple ceremony, it's not there. And I said, yes, but that's the entire
That's
problem.
not there
You're looking
exactly.
for the wrong ceremony. You want to look for the ancient ceremony. And if you do that, the temple is everywhere in the Book of Mormon. It's written by, like you say, temple visionaries who are using temple metaphors, temple language to show you what's going on. And you talk about you know, this great and abominable building. You know, I've just been in this essay I'm writing now. I'm, you know, quoting a lot from Jeremiah and Ezekiel. You know, they don't present a positive view of what's going on in the temple. You know, Jeremiah is the one that says, you know, you've turned my house into a den of robbers, which is the same language Jesus uses later. But it's Jeremiah calling it, you know, that Jerusalem is doing all these abominations, and you've changed my house and you're doing these abominations. So the language for, you know, great and abominable church is being applied to Jerusalem and the temple in Lehi's day. So if he's criticizing the establishment, he's got good company.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's interesting. I think people today still have, well, first of all, I think this is a non is a non-hypothetical and for some people an urgent conversation. I think there are people who struggle with the LDS Church, but who do believe Joseph Smith and are trying to find kind of other answers than the LDS Church. And I think there's a number of them who are still Kevin, kind of like you were talking about, looking for something that looks like a Kirtland Mormonism, right? And I think we can concede everybody, you know, sincerity, but I think also they're just wrong. It's a fundamental mistake to think, look, although this is what I was taught, right? Is hey, there's a burst of revelation right at the beginning. There's the Book of Mormon and some Doctrine and Covenants, and then I don't know, we go along, and later there's some other stuff that's temple stuff, and it isn't true. The temple stuff is embedded in the Book of Mormon from the beginning. It may be the case that Joseph doesn't realize it. It may be the case that he never realized it, right? But as you say, when you start looking for what is there, when you start trying to answer the question, here's the thing that Margaret Barker really did for me, okay, is she articulated a great question about the Bible. And the question about the Bible she articulated is, this guy Jesus shows up, okay, and people know who he is. They point, there's the family, he's that's his mom. Was his father not Joseph? And yet, despite the fact that they can do that, he is a known quantity. Somehow, by the time of what is it, the Epistle to the Galatians, you know, tw 20 years after he's dead, people are able to say Jesus is Yahweh, right? That's the basic declaration of Christian faith. And her question is, what is the existing furniture inside the head of these people that allows them to do that, right? And this is the basic.
That's exactly the question that I asked, that the primary question that I got when I read Margaret's work, introduced to by Kevin, by the way. He keeps just going, oh yeah, brush it off, but it literally changes the way we study the scriptures.
It's such a great question. and you start looking at things differently, right? And I also think it's very interesting to follow biblical scholarship as it evolves over time, right? Many of the sort of concepts that I just had, when I was a kid, I sort of thought, okay, I'm gonna stop making hand gestures. Is there a point? Oh, I guess you guys can see them. Listeners, I'm gonna make hand gestures. You don't get to see them. Ha. So
Listeners, be grateful you can't see them because some of them wouldn't be appropriate for
they're
Interpreter
awful.
Foundation. No.
So there's this idea that okay, we had the first temple and that's Judaism, and then we had the second temple and that's Judaism, and then Jerusalem falls. And there's still Judaism, and it's now rabbis, and then Christianity breaks off, and it's kind of a mutant thing. And that is a terrible description. That's not even close to being accurate, right? This is the model, the mental model I grew up with, but I think a lot of people did. It's now clear, right, from the archaeology, but also from the textual studies. There were lots of religions in the first temple, and probably none of them was Judaism. There were forms of Yahwism or Hebraism or something else, right? And they were at odds with each other. And then in the second temple, that was still true. Different heir parties that were heirs to the parties in the first temple period still fighting. And it was true after Jerusalem fell. For a long time, you right. Some people are now saying it was like the 4th century when the rabbis were really getting it together. That it really wasn't Judah the Prince. That rabbinical Judaism got its house in order about the same time that creedal Christianity did. Right. So and in those 3 centuries, you had the Gnostics and the Ebionites and whoever. So Margaret's question says, okay, hold on. We need to look back through this, all of these beasts in this complicated forest and figure out who was it that was passing down ideas that would make the first Christians' responses make sense, right? And that is a great question. So I said, I need to formulate a question, right? And the question I formulated was similar, and it was, what is the furniture in Nephi's head that makes the text of the small plates in particular, but the Book of Mormon? Book of Mormon's tricky. It's 1,000 years, right? So you got Mormon and Moroni and Nephi and Jacob, right? But like the small plates is basically Nephi and his immediate family, right? What must they know? What must they have experienced? What's the furniture in their head that makes the most sense out of the text? And that's
And
the
that's the
question.
ascent literature.
And I think the answer is that they were temple mystics, that they knew an ascent. I think if you look at some of the just high level observations about the Book of Mormon, it's obsessed with the Garden of Eden. Why is that? Right? It's obsessed with the Tree of Life. Why is that? It, by the way, weirdly, it's obsessed with the Nehushtan. The Nehushtan gets four mentions, is usually what they say in the Bible between the Old and the New Testament. It gets five in the Book of Mormon. So I think Lehi's party were temple mystics. I think that the most of the Book of Mormon was written or edited by men who were temple mystics. I think when you hit the occasional patches that were not, like Zenith, it's noticeably different.
Well, I think that Laman and Lemuel were Deuteronomists.
Oh, I think that's very true.
Val Larson has a really good article tracing, the Deuteronomist thing all the way through and showing how the after Jacob they seem to have won until there's another restoration with King Benjamin. I
Super interesting.
yeah, so he did some really good work on that. And also Neil Rapley did some good essays on that.
I don't know Neil. I love Val. He's one of the guys who, after my first books, called me. We'd occasionally have conversations on the phone about this stuff. If you look at Deuteronomy 13, it's hard not to see Laman and Lemuel in there, right? where it says, look, if somebody preaches a different God to you than the one that you've known, even if it's your brother, kill him, right?
Yeah.
And you go, oh man, if this is the thing that Laman and Lemuel are struggling with, right? Then there's a Laman and Lemuel reading of First Nephi that is really different,
Yeah.
which is they are trying their best not to kill their brother, even though they believe Moses says they should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there was one day in when I lived in Lawrence, Kansas, and Allison von Felt was in the same building in the other ward.
Oh,
And
yeah.
we were reading The Great Angel at the same time. And we both had the same lesson about Sherem. As we're passing each other in the hall, she just had the same, and we're just commenting to each other, don't you think Sherem is it talks like a Deuteronomist? And
Yeah.
just you start reading the same things, and then you can see the same things, and there's so much of it there. So it's not just that it has the first temple, but it they've taken the conflicts that were going on in Jerusalem with them. And I think, well, like. In 2004, I wrote an essay called "The Deuteronomist Dechristianizing of the New Testament,"
A
a
great
report
one, by the
of the
way.
Bible. Well, of the Bible, actually, yeah. And so it was of the Old Testament, really. And it's just once you start to see it, then you can't help it. And when I was at when Margaret came to the FAIR conference and spoke on Mother in Heaven, one of the guys at BYU, I think it was Gary Gillum, said to me that he said that I write like I'm not looking over my shoulder, which I'd never thought about. And that could be one of the reasons why I got involved on the ground floor in this, is because I didn't have as the preconceptions weren't as hammered into me. I was just
Well,
trying to.
you didn't live in Utah either.
Well, I grew up in Utah,
I know you did, but
and I
you
moved
didn't
away, but
write while you
yeah, and I
lived
wasn't
here.
an academic, much less
You
so than
bet.
if I just.
Sure. But that's the beauty of it. We have no academic reputations to protect.
Yeah,
Yes.
and I just started publishing things, and I'm looking back now, and I've published 43 essays, and I that's weird, but it's at this point I can't say must not have been accidental.
Yeah.
It's like this must have
That's
been my
right.
job, and I didn't know it until later.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Well, Dave, we want to thank you for taking the time to be with us. This has been fascinating, and we could go on for longer, but we do need to be wrapping up. So, could we get some final words, Mark and Kevin? You each have a final question for Dave?
You want to go first, Kevin?
Well, do you have any plans for doing anything else?
I am, well, two things. So one, Faith Matters invited me to curate a series of 12 presentations on, well, they said whatever you want. I said, how about next year's an Old Testament year? How about we do 12 presentations on the Hebrew Bible? So next year at Provo's, I think it's called the Compass Center. It's an art gallery between 2nd and 3rd West on Center Street. There will be a series of 12 presentations on the Hebrew Bible. So, yes, I have no academic reputation to protect. I have no tenure to earn. I want also no callings. I don't need to. I'm not worried about trying to make sure I can become a stake president or something. I mean, obviously, if you're listening, you can't see my long hair and mustache, but right, I have no
We're
church
going
career.
to get a headshot, Dave. We
Okay,
need a
perfect.
headshot.
Yeah.
Okay, I can arrange that. So, great. I want to help people get to a clearer relationship with the scriptures. The Old Testament is beautiful. I love it.
Yeah.
I don't trust it. You have to be careful with it. It shouldn't be taken naively. But there's great beauty and power in it. So that's thing one. Thing two, I'm actually writing a fourth book right now. I keep saying it's almost done. I'm not sure how close it really is to almost done. I'm going to try and take this argument out to the non-LDS world. So I'm writing a book that has no Book of Mormon in it. So what it will look like is an argument that Jesus was a teacher of a mystery. And here's what the mystery is, right?
Yeah.
And we'll see how that goes.
I think I may have some sources for that you could use.
Yeah. Well, I want to
So.
stick really close to the Bible because, I mean, it's like, so look, Nibley showed us decades ago that that if you're willing to read through the pseudepigrapha, you can reconstruct the temple in there easily, right? Then the problem is you're saying to Mormons, hey, your religion is in Zostrianos and the letter of the Rechabites and the first Enoch, right? And if I'm like, this is a construct in my head. It's not meant to sound demeaning, but if I'm Joe Pewhugger, right, I'm just like a guy in church. Like, really? Like, I can demonstrate my religion is true if I read Zostrianos. So I really wanted to stick very close to the Book of Mormon. And so for the same reason, this I really want to stick. Yeah, I'm gonna quote a little bit of this and that, but I really actually have a whole. I'm gonna do a whole chapter on the Gnostics, but only at the end, like an appendix. I really want to stick close to the New Testament, so New Testament readers can go, oh wow. But I'm happy to hear your sources, Terry.
Well,
Sounds fantastic.
we'll do that another time.
Okay.
Anyway, I would just indicate, Dave, what you just said about the Old Testament. I'm close friends with Stan McConkie, Bruce's son. I've talked about this on the program before, but he was, I asked him, well, why didn't your dad ever do a doctrinal commentary on the Old Testament the way he did the New? He said, my dad said we have no reliable text to use for the Old Testament. Just like you just said, Dave, he didn't trust it. He loved
Yeah.
it. He believed it. I think his best book for me is The Promised Messiah, where it's
Yeah.
all Old Testament prophecies of the
Yeah.
Messiah. But he did not trust it,
Yeah.
just like you were saying.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And ultimately, for two huge reasons, we should be very grateful for the Book of Mormon.
Oh, and that's
One,
one.
yeah, one is that the Old Testament is super complicated, and the Book of Mormon gives us a witness that says, look, there was this party in 600 BC, and here's what they thought. And so, whatever model you construct of the parties and politics of First Temple Judaism in the 7th century BC, like it has to accommodate the existence of Nephi and what he says, right? Like that's a witness that is dated. And I mean, people, I think, underestimate the extent to which one of the basic insights of modern biblical criticism is that most of the texts in the Bible were not written by who they say they are, when they said they were, and to the audience they say they are, right? Nephi's a sure nail. He's a witness in time. But the other thing is, the Book of Mor the Old Testament's very hard to translate to the pulpit because you can pick out 20 scripture mastery scriptures, but like you don't know what to trust. There are people, the parties that wrote these documents disagreed with each other, right? And some of the stories are just horrifying. So what do you do with it? And again, the answer is that the Book of Mormon gives us a bridge to the pulpit, gives us something. Hey, we don't know. The Book of Mormon is not infallible. These guys did not have perfect religion, but they had they're the witness God wanted us to have. And Joseph said, this book will get you closer to God than any other will, right? So that's massive. We are so hugely advantaged over everybody else who's trying to read the Bible. It's not even funny. I'm sorry,
Well,
I'm talking too much. Mark's supposed to ask a question.
I just want to follow up and say that I like that a lot, and I think that is really part of the value of the Book of Mormon. Another guy who does the radio show, Bruce. Oh, what's Bruce's last name? I just
That
forgot it.
border?
No, blank.
Webster.
Bruce Webster. Yeah. He's talked about one of the interesting things about the Bible versus the Book of Mormon. Sometimes he will find something in the Bible that'll say like Naaman had a donkey that was talking back to him, and there might be some question on whether or not that's real. And Bruce just brings up, are you going to find something like that in the Book of Mormon? Or is the Bible? And maybe, I think that's an interesting example too, because it works so
Yeah.
well. as this, kind of allegory, the Bible or the name on one hand and the donkey on the other, and you switch the nameplates, and all of a sudden the donkey's behavior is better suited to a prophet, and Naaman's behavior is better suit no, not Naaman, Balaam, I'm sorry,
Balaam.
Balaam, yeah, suited to the behavior of a donkey, all stubborn and unwilling to be led.
Spoken like a man with young children.
Yes, they are also unwilling to be led. But that's another story for another time. But the Book of Mormon doesn't have these crazy fancy elements in that, and I think that's kind of a another warning perhaps of not taking the Bible, not literally, but like you said, there needs to be a little suspicion there when you read.
Think carefully about what it is. If you read something like Giorgio de Santillana and Hertha von Decken's Hamlet's Mill, where they go into the stories about Samson and they say, look, his name means the sun, and there are, the number tallies in this account in the Book of Judges suggest that what's being recorded here is astronomical motions, not a historical account of an Israelite leader fighting against the Philistines, right? Like, and look, that doesn't have to disturb our belief in God, right? Like, the Bible is not inerrant. Neither is the Book of Mormon. That's okay. These are books that record the encounters of people with God. We're lucky to have all of them. We're especially lucky to have the Book of Mormon. We were lucky to have Joseph Smith, right? None of those are inerrant.
Yep, well said.
That's right. In our Come Follow Me interview we did with on Joseph F. Smith with Steve Taysom, he did make the comment that it's really difficult to sell to separate the revelation from the person who receives the revelation.
Is he the guy
And
who wrote the recent biography of Joseph Smith? That's a
we've
hard
had him on a
biography to
couple of
read.
times.
That's a hard biography to read in some of the chapters, and you're like,
Yeah.
ooh,
Yeah, it's
I
tough.
would have wanted him to be nicer.
It's tough, but you read where Joseph F. comes from, and that feeling comes out in the book. But it was really interesting. I find that with Nephi. I find that with the prophets of the Book of Mormon. Their revelations are personal to them, and each one has a different one. I mean, that's where you see the individuals, and you say, well, no, Joseph Smith couldn't have written this. There's just too many individuals. There's too much evidence for me of those kind of things.
Man, me too. I'm decades over that. I mean, just the sheer. So, I having written novels now, right? I will tell you, nobody stuck his face in a hat and in 75 days dictated a 264,000 word coherent historical account. It does not happen. Zero people in the
Zero.
history of the world have done anything similar. That's longer. I've written some long novels, some long epic fantasy novels. That's longer than any of them. And there's none of what we would consider editing. There's just some proofing. There's no developmental edit. We need to move the text around. You got this wrong. None, right? That book was given to Joseph the
Yeah,
way he described.
that's right. Well, Dave, we want to thank you for being with us, and we will have you on again when you've got your next projects done. And we look forward to hearing more about your Old Testament seminars this coming year. We're all looking forward to the Old Testament, I think, and we appreciate you being with us. So that's it for us tonight on the Interpreter Foundation. Please join us for another episode of the Interpreter Foundation podcast. I'm Terry Hutchinson, signing off for Mark Johnson, Kevin Christensen, and our special guest, Dave Butler. Thanks for being with us.
Cool. Thanks.